More women than ever before are rising to the tops of their professions, but we will talk with a guest this hour who argues that the success for these women ignores the struggles of millions left behind. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest argues that these successful women, the XX women, have more in common with successful men than they do with the rest of womankind. Have successful women attained equal rights and an equal paycheck with men? But are women now less equal with one another? We welcome your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Allison Wolfe, a professor of public sector management at King's College in London. She also advises the United Kingdom government on education policy and is the author of the book, The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. And she joins us from the Argo Studios in New York City. Hello, Professor Wolfe, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me to join you.
The title of your book claims the rise of working women has actually created a less equal world. How does that work?
Essentially, we have a larger elite than we ever did in the past, which has men and women in it. And elites have always had servants, and elites have always looked after themselves. And essentially, women in the elite are not significantly different from men in the elite in this respect. And their lives depend on their being servants, either in the home or very low-paid people outside the home who are doing things that make their lives possible. And that's always been true. What has changed is that getting on for a good half of that elite is now female. So it's not that there's anything particularly bad about female elites. They're just not significantly different in this respect from male elites. And of course, in the past, women were very alike. They all shared a lack of opportunity. They all shared a lack of independent, high-earned income. And the reality is that as women have entered the workplace and as about 15% of them have become very successful, taken good professional and managerial jobs, inequality among women has increased much faster than inequality among men. And you've also got increasingly a group of what I call super families, families where you've got two good incomes, two strong networks. And that's the reality of the modern elite. And it's one of the things which I think people tend to ignore because they tend to talk about women as though women were a distinct group that were all alike. And in the past, that was quite true. Any woman had a less or more successful life, basically, in terms of how well she married. Now, it isn't true at all.
Yeah, interesting. I see what you're saying, but as you mentioned, this has always existed. Isn't this the gap between the rich and the poor?
But it's the gap between rich women and poor women, and this is, I think, dramatically different. And it's also, and I think this is, I have to say, it's bad news for social mobility. It's also the creation of families where both partners are powerful, both partners are successful. And it's only been possible, brutally, because at the same time as this has happened, we've also had the return of the servant classes, where women in the 50s, these despised suburban mothers of the 1950s, did their own housework, basically. There were no nannies around. I mean, you could have walked around American or British suburbs in the 1950s and not a nanny in sight. What has happened with this is that it's been possible because we've been able to hire a large number of mostly pretty low-paid women to look after kids, to look after elderly parents, to do all those sorts of jobs. Many of them, but not all, immigrants. And that's a new phenomenon. That just didn't exist in the past. And of course, we've always had the rich and the poor. But this is a different sort of rich. And the flip side of the fact that women can be rich in their own right, part of a powerful partnership, is that lots of other women are not like that. And the idea that women have common interests is far less true than it ever has been in human history.
How is this different from the equality or inequality situation among men?
Well, the inequality among women has been increasing faster. And one of the things that's happened, I think, which has in a sense quite similar, is that what we've lost, of course, in the last 20 to 30 years are the sort of what people call breadwinner jobs, the kind of really well-paid, often manufacturing jobs, which were good enough for a whole middle-class family to live off. And so the same changes that have fueled inequality among men have also been part of this growing inequality in society. And a lot of women who are not professionals work part-time or indeed more than part-time, not because they particularly want to, because the jobs they're doing for the money, not because it's part of their identity. But that has happened. There are these changes to a service economy. There are these women who are very keen to get help with looking after children, parents, and who have the money to do it. And I think it's all part of the same thing, but somehow we haven't really focused on what it's done to women. We keep talking about women's interests, and we keep talking as though the best thing that could happen for women as a whole is to have more women on boards of companies. And this seems to me to totally ignore the fact that the top 15% of women are just very different from most other women. Their jobs are part of them. They are careers. They are identity. There are a lot of women out there who would love to work less, who are doing jobs purely for the money, and who were perfectly happy with a breadwinner kind of a society.
Why do you call these successful women the XX women?
Well, really just to point out that they are XX rather than XY, and that is, in a sense, it's not irrelevant that they have children and that they carry the babies and men don't. But in a way, it's that difference, important though it is almost the only difference between the male and the female elites. Now, you could say it's a big difference, and of course it is a big difference. But also, a lot of successful women actually don't have children anymore, and a lot of successful men don't have children anymore. But actually, the real truth is, I was trying to think of a title, and my beloved cousin said, why don't you call it the XX factor? So, you know, I thought that was a brilliant idea, and I said thank you in the acknowledgements.
But the XX women have more in common with successful men than they do with the rest of women.
I think they do. I really do think they do. We obviously, there is this period when you're having children when it does still tend to be the women who take the major role, the major lead. But as I said, many women and many men don't have children. Many of them only have one. And as our careers get longer and longer, the period of your life when a small child or even a teenager is a dominant fact about how you plan your day is actually a shrinking percentage.
Yeah. I pulled this factoid out of the book. 70 million highly educated, high-earning women around the world who are earning close to what men are earning have closed that wage gap. But more are being left behind. That's
absolutely true. What I did, and it's probably as it rises by the day, because one of the things that was really remarkable when you looked at the statistics was how quickly the change is occurring in developing countries. So yes, essentially, I took the professional and managerial classes, what sociologists would call sort of class one jobs, all around the world, and there are different proportion of the jobs in developed and developing countries. And the proportion of them that are female are different, though the developing world is closing the gap fast. And half of those jobs in the developed world are now held by women. And so when you do your basic arithmetic, you end up with 70 million and rising by the day. And that's an awful lot of people.
Yeah. And there are more women billionaires in China?
It's got the most self-made female billionaires in the world by quite a large margin. And I think that's for two reasons. I mean, first of all, China is kind of a frontier economy. I mean, one of the very successful billionaires herself said this, that, you know, when a when an economy is exploding, you have opportunities for outsiders that you don't have at other times. But I also think it sort of underlines the fact that whereas in the US or in the UK, when we had the sort of incomes per head that China or India have today, there were almost no really successful women industrialists. I mean, virtually none, and almost no female lawyers. You look at China, you look at India, you look at Thailand today, and they are just full of really successful women.
The title of your book, perhaps this was a working title, or it was the title when it first came out in the UK, perhaps, How Working Women Are Creating a New Society.
And why did I change it? Somebody else asked me this, and that, of course, it is about how working women are creating a new society. But the, I will tell you the absolute truthful story, and you can believe it or not. We had a problem with publication in the UK. It came out slightly earlier, and the copy editor was very unwell, and we nearly didn't make the publication date. And we literally decided the cover sort of 3 days before we went to press, and then realized we didn't have a subtitle. And my publisher there said, oh my goodness, we have to have a subtitle. And it was the work of 5 minutes. And so with the US, it seemed important to have a subtitle that was perhaps a bit more informative and that actually tried to get to the core of the book. And some days I like one better and some days I like the other better. But I think the U.S. title is better, really.
Well, and it's interesting to find out how that happened, but I guess I was thinking creating a new society, is this the new normal, or is this is it going to evolve into something else? Are we going to close the inequality gap?
I quote this in the book as well. There's this famous saying, never predict anything, especially the future. Mm. But And part of me is absolutely sure there's something coming up from behind that we are just not expecting, that will just transform things. Who would have expected that the nuclear family, that marriage would fall apart as much as it has? But I have to say, it's hard for me to see in the current economy, and that's what, my professional life I look at, it's hard to see how we're going to close that gap. Essentially, the old manufacturing jobs are just, they're not going to come back. Even if manufacturing comes back, it's never going to employ the numbers of people that it used to. We can do things much more easily with robots and mechanization, much more efficiently. So I think manufacturing is kind of going the same way as agriculture, and there just won't be those jobs. So looking as far ahead as I dare, my predictions would be that we're not going to close the gap, though we could redistribute more than we do. I mean, we don't need to have the levels of financial inequality that we do. I mean, personally, I think they're obscene. And you don't need to have those. But in terms of, are we going to have a different sort of labour market? I don't see it coming. It seems to me that we are stuck for at least several decades with about a sixth, 15% of the population doing really highly rewarded, fulfilling, knowledge society type jobs, and the bulk of the population really finding jobs in the service sector, working on shifts, it's a 24-hour type sector, doing jobs which are essentially not well rewarded and which you basically do for the money. So I'm not optimistic. I think there are things that you can do that make it better for people. And, again, sticking my European oar in, I'm delighted that the United States is finally doing something about health coverage for people. Mm-hmm. But I think the structure of the labour market is not something that I can see changing in the future. And my hunch would be that all over the world, we're going to have yet more highly successful women. I don't actually ever think we will have 50% of the partners in a Wall Street law firm female. But I think that we will stabilize, that this 50-50 split is in the top group of jobs is going to become the worldwide pattern. But it's just that top group is going to remain pretty small, pretty different, men and women working together, whereas in the rest of the population, it's very different.
We are talking with Alison Wolfe. She's a professor of public sector management at King's College in London. She is the author of the book, The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. We welcome your questions. Do you agree with our guest? As a woman, what has your experience in the workforce been? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Alison Wolfe. She is the author of The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. With more and more women rising to the top of their professions, working long hours, starting families later, or foregoing families entirely, our guest is arguing that the success of these women ignores the struggles of the millions left behind. And we welcome your input, your questions, your experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Cody in Oshkosh is our first caller. Hello, Cody.
Hello, thank you. I was wondering if possibly these rich and powerful women will help maybe make some of the political changes that we need, or do you not have much faith in that? And also, have the Nordic capitalist countries such as Sweden, the Netherlands, possibly even Great Britain, have a less divergence of wealth among women because of a strong social safety net?
Good questions.
Shall I answer straight away? Yes. Okay, can I start with a second question? Because I think the Scandinavian pattern and experiences are really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I want to start with something which people don't ever believe until they stop and think about it, which is that the Scandinavian countries have the most gender-segregated labour markets in the world. In other words, as a woman, if you're a Scandinavian woman, you are more likely to do a job where everybody else is female than you are in any other countries in the world. And that is because what they have actually done is they have, if you like, socialized what used to go on inside the house to a greater degree than the rest of us. So they had day nurseries first. They had after school care first. They had lots and lots, and still do lots and lots of help with looking after your elderly, looking after your sick. But what basically happened there was that all the women who used to do this for nothing inside the house, the vast majority of them then moved into doing very, very traditional female jobs outside the house. Now, there are pluses, of course, you know, that these are secure jobs in a way they probably aren't in the US, but they are incredibly female jobs. And the Nordic countries don't actually have a particularly good record. They don't have a particularly bad record, but they don't have a particularly good record of getting women into the top jobs. They have a lot of female politicians, almost no female bankers. And as I said, these are really segregated patterns. Now, what they do provide is they do provide this social safety net, and it's absolutely admirable. It's, I think, possible because they are small, homogeneous societies that feel they can and should look after each other. But they don't end up with incredibly progressive labour market structures in the sense of women being far more equally spread across the jobs. One of the things that I should underline, I think, is that one of the differences between elite women and the other 85% is that the top 15%, the jobs are increasingly integrated. You know, you work for men, but men work for you, and your colleagues are male and female. Whereas most women in the world work in very, very female workforces, doing very traditional jobs, a bit like the Scandinavians. So do I think that rich and powerful women will be dramatically different in the way they approach politics? I'm actually not convinced, to be truthful. I think that what the emancipation of women has shown is that among educated women, opinions are more diverse than people expected and pretty much as diverse as among men. But having said that, I mean, it's a good idea to have twice the talent. And it is true that women do, to a degree, see things differently. And one of the things that is quite interesting is that women tend to vote a bit differently from men. Actually, the biggest gaps are in the US and Scandinavia, and maybe I know why for Scandinavia. I still don't understand why for the US. But the reality is that it's still women who have the biggest responsibility for the family. And even at the top, I think that women are more inclined to think about issues like, so what happens if the kids are ill? What happens when parents get elderly? And one of the, again, very interesting things is that in this country, senators who have daughters vote differently from senators who don't have daughters. They are that bit more inclined to support social programs. So I think there may be a bit of a difference, and being a woman is still different from being a man. But do I believe that if it had been Lehman sisters instead of Lehman brothers, nothing would have happened? No, I don't. Not at all.
Well, we're talking about the Scandinavian countries. Is there any country where women work at high levels or are, you know, elite without massive inequality at lower education levels?
You mean, are there countries where there is really, really equality?
Yeah.
Where because, you know, I do want to emphasize that the inequality among women is because women have joined the elite and the elite have always done very well for themselves. I mean, I have to say it's hard to think of them. I mean, there are countries which are more egalitarian in terms of income spread. And, you know, one of the aspects of the US is you've always had this kind of rawness, which is your strength, as well as produces some, you know, this feeling that you can fall through the bottom. The Scandinavian countries are more homogeneous. They are more, they are in income terms much more equal. They have greater educational opportunity at the bottom. They don't have greater social mobility in and out of the elites than we do. In terms of real equality, I'd have to say there really aren't any utopias out there. There are varying degrees. Some of the European countries have less inequality, considerably less income inequality than the US or indeed the UK. But a utopia, I honestly don't think we have one. People used to think it was Iceland, but that was before the Icelandic banks went mad. So Iceland's probably as good as you're going to get even now, but it has less than 1 million people.
Here's a Karen on Facebook who says, I'm a healthcare professional and I work in an office with several female professional and a large number of female support staff. I have to mask some of the luxuries that I enjoy. I have a housekeeper, luxury vacations, in order to keep an easy professional relationship with the other women who are struggling to make ends meet. A reaction to that, Professor?
Totally recognize it, feel absolutely the same. I mean, one of the things that working on this area and looking at the statistics has done for me is it's actually made me deeply embarrassed at how fortunate I have been and am. Well, embarrassed is perhaps not the right word, hopefully grateful. A feeling that I never appreciated how fortunate I was being right through my career compared to most other people. So I completely, totally recognize this. And one of the things also where actually I think the US is better than most places and should be aware of this, one of the sort of depressing things is how little people give back. You know, we all tend to want to congratulate ourselves, but the reality is that even in retirement, the vast bulk of quite advantaged people are not giving large sums of money away, though, as I said, this country is probably the best in the world on that. They're not giving huge amounts of time volunteering, even when they are no longer working themselves into the ground. And I do think that, yeah, I'm going to say, I actually get very cross when highly advantaged women spend their time whinging about the fact that there aren't enough female CEOs, because most women are struggling.
Let's take another call from Milan in Duluth. Hello, you're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I agree totally with the analysis of your guest. In fact, I think that the rise of women will bring a greater social stratification because the women who rise to the top tend to be the wives are the daughters of the men already in power. And a little anecdote to illustrate this. At the Dulles Airport in Washington, a high-power couple with a toddler, and the toddler is having a tantrum on the floor. This is a witness, the situation. And the toddler is yelling, "I don't want another nanny." I'd like the comments of your guest.
Okay, I'm going to say something. I sympathize as somebody who's been an employer of nannies and was actually very lucky. And I don't know what I would have done if I'd had the experience of some people I know and sort of nanny number six packs it in. But I will say something defensive of these high-powered couples, which is that, again, this doesn't really help with the social stratification, but they are incredibly intense parenters. They put huge amounts of time as well as energy and money into the parenting. And again, I don't know whether this is... You guys are in Wisconsin, and I have this illusion that maybe it's less stressful than in London or New York. But professional advantaged couples are also deeply anxious all the time about whether or not they can preserve things for their kids. And they go in for this very intensive parenting. They put more hours, even when they're both working full time, they put more hours in the week into sort of one-to-one activities with their kids than anybody else in the population. And one of the things that's really fascinating, and I have quite a lot about this in my book, is watching the change in how people allocate their time compared to, say, the 1920s, the 1940s, the 1960s. And one of the most dramatic changes is the amount of time that mothers and fathers in the elite groups put into really interacting with their kids. They spend hours and hours a week on it, whereas, you know, I really did have the kind of, you know, get out of the house and don't come back till lunchtime sort of childhood. And that is absolutely not the pattern in any of the big world cities where a large number of these couples live. And I don't know, maybe it's not yet as stressful if you can get out of the away from the coasts and out of London, out of Paris, out of Stockholm. Tell me that it's not as bad.
Yeah, actually, I can't speak for the stress of the elites, but I can attest that that there's certainly stress in this job too. But I'm curious, what is it that makes the elite woman elite, and the other is still struggling?
Basically, education. Overwhelmingly. And of course, there are people for whom that's not true. The Chinese billionaires that I noticed, I mean, this is very much like 19th century America. And there are women among the billionaires, the self-made billionaires in China, who have come literally from nowhere and have, well, there's one woman who is a very classic example of that. Her husband left her. She had one child. She left him with her grandparents, with his grandparents, went to the city, became an incredibly successful saleswoman, created this air conditioning business. But for the developed countries, increasingly the route to the top is education. And education has been fantastic for women because they do well at it. And if you have a highly credential society, one which sort of really rewards formal education, it's very good for women, first of all, because women do well at it, and secondly, because it's very difficult for an employer to turn around and give a job to somebody who's got a worse education when there's a woman who's got a really much better education. And then, of course, once you've discovered that the woman is just as, you know, the women are just as good as the men, then the world changes. So education has been fantastic, but it's also something that works for the elite generation on generation, because if you've come into these jobs, and as I said, I simply define them the way sociologists do, but they are the graduate jobs. They're the jobs where you use your brain, the jobs where, as I said, it's part of your personal identity, the jobs which they haven't got rich as fast as the bankers, but they have gone on doing really quite nicely for the last 20 years. Having got there, parents then are very aware that was the way they got there. They worry about how their children will do in a very competitive global economy, and they're therefore determined to to get the same sort of educational success for their children as they know worked for them. And so I think the danger is that this education-based elite, these people who got there through a formal education rather than because of their parents' money, let alone their parents' family status, then are in a very, very good position to make sure that their children also get a really good education. So on the one hand, I think education is wonderful, but I do feel that people who think that education is the answer to social mobility are perhaps kidding themselves a little, because if you have two highly educated parents who are also deeply anxious about their children's future and know how the world works, they are going to pour effort into their kids' education. And so it's not like this is an equal playing field.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with the author of The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. Alison Wolfe is a professor of public sector management at King's College in London. She also advises the United Kingdom government on education policy. We welcome your questions for our guest and your experiences as a woman in the workforce. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Kerr-Dean talking with Alison Wolfe, who is the author of The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. And our next caller is Stephen in Kenosha. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
I think it's a compelling argument, and you may not want to answer my question. If you want to take a pass, I'll totally be cool with that. I'm curious about what specific demographic that you had in mind in writing your book. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Stephen, wondering that?
Why am I wondering that, I guess? I think that the answer or the solution to the conundrum probably exists in which demographic she wrote the book for. You know, say it was written for, you know, college-age women, college-age men, both. Whatever demographic the book was written to, I think is probably where the solution comes from.
Well, I'm not sure if it's where the solution comes from. I mean, I think the answer is that inevitably I wrote this sort of book for the sort of people that are the main players in it, though the rest of the world does figure too. It's not just about the elite. It's also about the lives of the people who are not the elite. I mean, the reality is, and that actually, you know, I don't want to overdo this because there are plenty of, you know, incredibly serious readers among non-college graduates and plenty of college graduates I know who don't do anything except watch bad television. But the reality of the publishing market, like broadsheet newspapers, like I would guess public radio, is that most readers of the sort of book are going to be the kind of people that the book is about, because they are the people who buy that sort of book. And one of the things which is really extraordinary is how far on a whole load of things affluent graduate professionals behave differently in all sorts of ways from the vast bulk of the population. It's not just the inequality thing. It's like when they get married, when they have their children, how many children they have, you know, a whole range of things. You sort of take anything that you think of and you say, okay, let's look at graduates versus non-graduates, and hey, there's a difference, you know, a really marked difference. So the answer is I did write it inevitably for the sort of people that I'm talking about, but I wrote it for the men, not just for the women. And actually, interestingly, I think that I wouldn't say that men find it more interesting than women do. They find it less disturbing, I suppose, because they don't feel I'm getting at them as much as women might. Because to them, this makes a lot of sense. They have always felt that while being a man was a part of their identity, it wasn't the completely defining thing about it. Whereas in the past, being a woman was by a mile the most important thing about being a woman. So I wrote it for men and women, I suppose, to a degree. I wrote it for my daughter. Why not? But I had to write it for people like that. I don't think they have a solution, but I think they could behave a bit better, myself included. And they are the people I hope will read it, because what I also feel, and maybe this is partly an answer, I don't have a solution. I don't think everything in life has a solution, and I certainly don't think that I have the faintest idea how to change the structure of the labour market. But I do believe, to quote one of my great long-dead countrymen, that knowledge is power, that the more you understand the society you're in, the more you can actually do something about it. And so, you know, I'm an academic. I write partly to educate, partly in this book I hope to entertain and inform. I would like people to look at the world a little differently by the time they've read it.
Bonnie Jean emails, I think a piece of this conversation is full-time working mothers versus stay-at-home moms. There is now an intense conversation among us regarding our motives, values, and decisions that we make, which is unfortunate because it seems to thrive off of our insecurities as mothers and tear us apart. We are all women, and we should respect each other for our individual decisions. A response to that, Alison Wolfe.
I think there is an enormous amount of tearing apart between stay-at-home mothers and full-time working professional mothers. But I would say, at the risk of being... What I would like to say is most women who work don't have the choice to stay at home. To stay at home as a full-time mother and have a decent standard of living in the modern world is something that just isn't available to large parts of the population. And I therefore think it's particularly unreasonable that women who go to work, who could afford to stay home but who are following their careers and for whom this is really important, and women who can afford to stay at home as mothers, it's really unfortunate that they tear apart at each other, because actually both groups are highly privileged. And one of the things that's actually quite interesting is that among the very rich, there are far more stay-at-home mothers, for the obvious reason. My own feeling is that one of the things that sort of slightly reassured me was that one myth, which is that working mothers don't have any time for their children, is clearly untrue. What it did make me aware of is that working full-time as a mother, you know, you are in some key respects the loser. I'm sure your children also lose certain things. But what I keep wanting to say is both of these groups, full-time working professional mothers and full-time stay-at-home mothers who are not living on the breadline, not those sort of living on a tiny welfare check, but those who actually have the ability to make that choice, they should... please both be aware that this is a unique choice in female history. For this to be a choice is something that we've never had before, and only some of us have it now.
There's very little house husbanding going on right now?
Almost none. Absolutely none. The media adore house husbands. They love them. Because they're still so unusual, there's very, very little. If you have a household in which the husband is not working and the wife is, or in which the wife is earning considerably more, this will almost always be lower down the economic scale. It won't be at the top. Most households in which the woman is the sole earner, it's because the husband is unemployed, not because he's a well-kept house husband. Women just don't go for it.
And you also say in the book that women and men pretty much work the same number of hours, even when accounting for household chores?
Yeah, they do. And I know nobody will believe me about this, but this idea of the second shift, this idea that women put in just the same number of hours at the work and then come home and do all the housework, it is just isn't true. If you add up all over the world, I'll come to the exception in a minute, all over the world, if you add up the number of hours doing, you know, I don't want to call it grunt work because people enjoy their jobs often, but if you add up household work, yard work, household bureaucracy, work at the paid work outside the house, what is extraordinary is that the number of work hours that men and women put in all over the world average out as identical. Now, you know, of course there are exceptions. Of course there are families where, you know, you've got a, somebody is linked up to, married to, lives with someone who bullies them unbearably. This will often be a woman who's being bullied and doing more work. There will be cases where actually, for whatever reason, the husband works crazily hard and the wife doesn't. He has a taste for different sort of woman. But on average, the amount is equal, absolutely equal when you add all the bits up. The major exception is Italy, because the women there seem to be completely obsessive about their housework.
I guess I can't move there.
No. I have a real problem with it myself.
Where does this this figure that we see all the time in terms of the wage gap that, you know, women make whatever 79 cents to the men's dollar? Where does that come from?
Well, again, it's the averaging, and what you're doing there is you're putting all women together with all men, and the reality is that a much larger proportion of women work part-time, and part-time is always paid less on average, and a very large proportion of women are working in these new, very badly paid service sector jobs. So in that sense, if you're looking at the non-elite women, on the whole, women are still earning less on average because they're working part-time, because they have interrupted their work patterns. And that, again, that's always really bad news for your lifetime earnings, for where you are when you're sort of in your 50s. And they're doing an awful lot of these jobs, which are, in certainly in the US and the UK, very poorly paid. So that average figure just puts all sorts of things together. If you look at professionals in their 20s and 30s. Actually, in their 20s, the women are actually coming out ahead in terms of median income. But if you look at women in their and men in their 20s and 30s, and if you look at people doing the same job who have had the same amount of work time in the workplace, same work history, same education, then, as I said, they are paid exactly the same. And in fact, among young professionals in their 20s, women are doing a bit better. Now, of course, it's still true that mostly if anybody interrupts work or goes part time because of kids, it will be women. But it's now possible to do some really pretty sophisticated stuff with these data. And what academics have always looked for is, was there a female penalty over and above the fact that you might have gone part-time, might have not taken a not put in the extra hours while you had small children? Was there something over and above that? Was there some sign of real discrimination? And the answer is that for people in their 50s, they still bear a bit the scars of previous tendency by employers to think, oh, I won't give her the promotion, she won't come through. Among people in their 20s and 30s, there is no sign whatsoever that women are actually discriminated against as women. I mean, none, zilch.
Let's take another call from Carol in Muscadet. Hello, Carol.
Hello. And I may be very unfair because I just barely turned on the radio, but I thought, oh, no, not another one. Okay, I think there's a lot of backlash to this idea, and it's not a new idea. In rural Wisconsin, for instance, this dynamic has played out across the U.S., but in rural Wisconsin, you have, in certain pockets, a contempt and animosity for teachers. Teachers are mainly women. Women make money and benefits. Their benefits are being taken away from them, their pensions, because it is such a politically potent thing for the reigning powers here to attack the women for being elitist because they're educated. Doesn't matter how poor you are. If you're educated, you are here politically an elitist. And it's fair game to be attacked on that basis, politically and socially, et cetera, et cetera. So this is something that is very extreme in the U.S. Now, China's like a lab. We can watch this happening very fast. And the same thing with some European countries and some other developing countries. But it's established here, and it's turned around, and what you hear is this backlash. Poor men, they don't get the benefits, they don't get the good stuff, and many men are married to teachers, and they are not educated here, and necessarily those husbands, and they are the right-wingers, and the women have to be very careful about not being a right-winger.
Carol, I need to jump in. What are you attacking the elite teachers that you know, Carol's worried about, that we think that if you're educated, you're fair game?
Well, I have to say, it seems to me that this, our world is being inherited by the educated. So maybe we can put up with a few brickbats about people insulting us for being elitist. I mean, I'm certainly not going to, you know, I'm a teacher. I'm a university teacher, but I'm a teacher. That's what I do. And I believe passionately that whether or not it gets you a job, being educated is about what it makes you more alive. It makes life better. It makes you understand things. It makes you better able to deal with things. I'm really shocked to discover that in Wisconsin, of all states, people are attacked as elitist because they are educated. And all I can say is, the world is hungry for education. Education is the way to the top. The what I was describing earlier, which is the sort of the tension among professional families who are so anxious about their kids, certainly in the big cities and in societies as a whole, the whole of China, the whole of Japan, parents are desperately anxious about education because they see it as the way that their children will succeed economically, as well as in, you know, perhaps to the exclusion of the broader aspects of education. So, I mean, if people are attacking teachers as elitist, you know, I obviously can't get into the benefits business because this sounds like it's Wisconsin politics, on which I really have no expert view and no right to voice an opinion. But this is a world in which education matters more than it ever has ever in the past. And if you are working in an industry which matters so much to people, ultimately, I don't see how you can lose status. I mean, being a teacher matters desperately because how far children do well in education matters more and more and more to what will happen to them in life. And on the plus side, one of the things I've been encouraged by in, again, both the US and the UK is the fact that there's been something of a switch, that more highly educated graduates are going back into teaching than was true sort of 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that is partly because of the recognition that education is so central to success and indeed survival in modern societies.
Allison, we have just a minute to go. We have Bernard who emails what could be a good concluding question here, but only a short time to answer it. What endpoint are you striving for?
I would like the world to be more aware of its advantages. I would like the elite to be more aware of their advantages. I would like them to understand, and I would like society to understand these forces so that they can see how they can mitigate them. I don't think there is a magic answer. Maybe that's just because I'm a cynical European. But I do believe that if you are conscious of where inequality comes from and conscious of where advantage comes from, it's easier to deal with it. And I also hope that being aware of their privileges will make the elite a bit more willing to put something back in.
Thank you very much for being with us. Allison Wolfe is a professor of public sector management at King's College in London. She also advises the United Kingdom government on education policy. She is the author of the book, The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come, including tomorrow at this time. It's the Week in Review. We'll have two guests from different political perspectives talking about the week's top news stories. That's the Week in Review every Friday at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.